I hope you didn't wait until this point to learn what the progenitors are of type 1a supernovae, because going to high redshift is probably not the best place to try to identify them. Usually we go to high redshift to learn more about cosmology and about changes to the expansion rate of the universe. So the talk title I was given was Lessons Learned from Supernovae of Type 1a at Redshift Greater Than 1. So I'll talk a little bit about cosmology, and then I'll discuss a little bit about what we might learn about evolution and rates of supernovae. So as I said, the reason that you go to higher redshift is to understand cosmology, and in particular, the reason that we were motivated to go to higher redshifts was to follow up on the discovery of dark energy in 1998 and try to get unique information about testing that model. So as Michael described, we had these two models that were both decelerating a little bit or a lot of bit. And then we ended up with this accelerating universe filled with dark energy, but presumably decelerating at higher redshifts when the universe was matter-dominated, and we see structure forming at high redshifts. So by going to higher redshift, we hope to validate the supernovae. Now, there are other ways we look to validate type 1a supernovae. This is sort of a list from maybe least impressive to more impressive. There are good theoretical underpinnings for type 1a supernovae. Of all the standard candles that we use to measure the expansion rate of the universe, type 1a supernovae are probably the only objects that have a good reason to be a standard candle, the Chandrasekhar limit. And so that is a nice thing that exists with the type 1a supernovae that isn't true of other objects, Cepheids or whatnot. And even though there are still some aspects of the spectra to work out in terms of modeling, it's still fairly impressive that we get good agreement of the models of the spectra to the observed spectra, which demonstrate that we're certainly on the right track. I think more impressive are the local tests we've done. So the local universe provides a laboratory for a large range of ages and metallicities for the supernovae. And so a number of speakers have shown that the distance measurements we produce from type 1a supernovae at a wide range of environments, from old galaxies to young galaxies, metal-rich, metal-poor environments, we don't see any residual dependence of the observed distance on the environment of the supernova. So the supernovae seem relatively insensitive to their environment as distance indicators, and so we think if the supernovae don't know what time it is in their galaxy, how do they know what time it is in the universe? So that's probably one of the stronger lines of evidence we have. And then we've gone to higher redshifts, and we've looked in detail at these high redshift supernovae, at their spectral energy distribution. I'll show more about that. Their light curve shapes and their colors, things that don't depend on the cosmology. And to date, we still see no evidence for any evolution from the rules that we are used to with type 1a supernovae. But our goal by going to higher redshift was to look for a very interesting effect. The difference for the supernovae between cosmology, where a decelerating universe at higher redshifts will make the supernovae look relatively brighter, versus a never-before-discovered astrophysical source of dimming of the supernovae that fooled us into thinking there was dark energy in the first place. So some kind of gray dust, some kind of evolution, would presumably continue as you went to higher redshift. Whereas, even though we don't fully understand what dark energy is, we know the universe was matter-dominated at high redshift, so it must be decelerating. And so about 5 years ago, we formed this team to look for these distant supernovae, not from the ground, but from the Hubble Space Telescope, because, and as Mark showed nicely in his talk, it becomes very difficult from the ground to get above about a redshift of 0.9 from the ground. And so we were looking for these high redshift supernovae both to confirm the reality of dark energy, and if we believe ultimately in dark energy, to begin to measure any changes in the properties of dark energy itself. And so we've been the TACs have been very generous to us to give us time to make these kinds of observations over the last few years. And so to date, that is until ACS died, unfortunately, a couple of months ago, we found about 50 type 1a supernovae. We have actually found 135 supernovae of all types and redshifts. But the most interesting objects, because they're unique, are the ones above a redshift of 1. And so we have about 23 of those, and we're unlikely to obtain any more until hopefully ACS is repaired in the future. And so here's what their host galaxies look like. Again, we see full range of host galaxy types at high redshift as we do at intermediate and low redshifts. So the way we generally identify these type 1a supernovae to trigger follow-up with the Hubble Space Telescope is from their colors. And so we look for this characteristic ultraviolet deficit. The UV colors of type 1a supernovae are red compared to the most common contaminant, which would be core collapse supernovae. So we measure photometric redshifts of the host galaxies that allow us to identify what the observed colors correspond to in the rest frame, and we look for the signature, which might look something like this, and for a core collapse supernova would look like this. And so here's what a type 1a supernova looks like at redshift 1.3 with ACS. This is actually quite easy for HST, and in fact this will be an important aspect of my talk as we get on to rates, but just to show you, this is, you know, easily a 20 sigma detection. Then we use the near-infrared camera on HST NICMOS to measure the rest frame optical colors, because type 1a supernovae are better distance indicators in the rest frame optical than in the ultraviolet. And then we use the slitless GRISM mode on the ACS to measure the spectrum and extract that. And here's a pretty good match of a type 1a supernova at redshift 1.3 to a low redshift object. And so, like this, we're on our way collecting many of these objects. Of course, we measure the light curve as well to do the usual light curve shape corrections. So this basically is what we get. You've seen a number of these cosmology Hubble diagrams of type 1a supernovae, and what's different about this one simply is the high redshift end. And so the objects discovered with HST have almost doubled the redshift range at which we can track the expansion history of the universe. Here's the residual Hubble diagram. And so indeed what we see, and you could look in the paper and see how we do this in a model-independent way, but basically, yes, the universe accelerates recently, but at higher redshift, it decelerates. It's, of course, not purely decelerating, it's not purely accelerating, but kinematically speaking, it's a mixture of the two, and you could say that statement very model-independently just by doing an expansion of H of T in higher and higher terms. The astrophysical news is we don't see evidence for continual dimming of the supernovae. We don't know exactly what that would look like, but the data looks quite consistent with the turnover of in the Hubble diagram that we expect from deceleration and being dark matter dominated at high redshift. The dynamical news, I guess, is that we can learn something about dark energy, in particular about changes to dark energy from these two different regions that help break degeneracies in understanding how the equation of state could change with time. So let me first start out, just because this is the most common way that people look at the equation of state as a function of redshift, they try to expand it, either a value now and a derivative type term, or a value now and a sort of softer term that has a certain prescription. It multiplies z over 1 plus z, so it has more subtle changes. And so adding supernovae at high redshift, of course, helps break degeneracies for these two parameters because they have a different redshift dependence. And so in this space, just adding, you know, these 23 supernovae halves the confidence intervals in this space. But the problem, really, to my mind is, and this is, here's, I'm going to go kind of into a rant about how you look at W of Z. The truth is, we have no idea what the right form for W of Z is. And using these particular functions actually adds a great deal more information to the problem than we have any right to inject into this if we really are ignorant about dark energy. And in fact, the best way to show that is a diagram like this. If you use the data that we have and you allow W of Z to do what it wants, depending on what functional form you use, here's what the uncertainty in W of Z looks like as a function of redshift. So if you allow a very free form for W of Z, some arbitrary fourth order polynomial, it can go up, it can go down, it can oscillate, whatever, you know, only driven by what the data constrains it to do, you could see that our uncertainty, although we have good knowledge of W of Z at low redshift, as we go to high redshift, we quickly lose constraint on this, although certainly adding data at high redshift makes a big difference. If we use one of these models like W of A, which I think Michael said, so I'll quote him, and said he said that was a stupid thing to do. I think it's just a bad idea to do because it implies a great deal of knowledge about W of Z that we just don't have. If the data isn't telling us what W of Z is, and that's what a model like this does, then how can we just inject so much information? It's like a prior that's very strong that we have no justification for using. So I think we really ought to let the data be our guide as to what W of Z looks like. One reasonable way, I think, to do this, there are many ways to do this, is to look at some kind of components of W of Z that can be anything. So here's just an example where I did this at a low redshift, medium redshift, and high redshift. This follows a nice paper by Herderer and Couré on how to do this. And then you could throw in information from baryon acoustic oscillations and from WMAP, and you could begin to resolve the equation of state. And what you actually see is we have very little constraint on it at the high redshift end. And of course, seeing W not equal to minus 1 at any of these components and as a whole is something where we could learn a great deal by rejecting a cosmological constant. But for now, we can only say very crude things about dark energy at high redshift, mostly just that we see evidence for it being there because we see some kind of term with a negative equation of state, which is the hallmark of dark energy. So now let me go on for the supernova, type 1a supernova fans, away from cosmology, but about what we can learn from these objects at high redshift. And so here are 20 of the spectra we obtained for high redshift ones with the ACS GRISM. And to first order, even to second order, they look like a good match to nearby type 1a supernovae. If you sit there and use your library of type 1a supernovae at low redshift, you could almost always find a match to the objects that we see at high redshift. And as Mark showed, a nice way to look at that is in terms of a composite spectrum. There's no one way or one recipe to make a composite spectrum. You're averaging things that, you know, at some level, you shouldn't probably be averaging. You should look at individually. But you could plot ahead anyway, and here are a few different ways that you could combine the 13 spectra we have around a redshift of 1.2 and the average spectrum that we obtain at high redshift looks strikingly similar to the one at low redshift. And at some point soon, I think Mark and Richard will probably compare this to the good spectrum that they have at intermediate redshift. But you know, the area that we've been told by theorists to really keep our eye on is this ultraviolet region, where we should have, if there's a metallicity dependence, we should see the biggest change there. It's not obvious to me what the sign of the change is, but they've pointed us to that region, and they said keep your eye on that region. And I don't see a difference here, and I didn't see a difference with the spectrum that Mark showed, but you know, this is work in development. So I would say, you know, as of now, we see no evidence for evolution, and maybe the one improvement by going to higher redshift is we have a longer lever arm on the look-back time, and so if we would see evolution, we would hope it would get stronger so we could ferret it out at high redshifts. Same with the light curve shapes and colors. In black are the supernova light curves we use at low redshift, and in red are the points at high redshift. And although maybe we don't see the very fastest decliners, because those are the most subluminous, we pretty much see the full range of supernova decline rates at the highest redshifts that we see, although they are, as Andy showed, they are tilted a little bit more towards the slow decliners, the more luminous supernovae. We see type 1a supernovae in elliptical galaxies. Even in the field at high redshift, we have about 9 of these. And so we heard a number of talks about how these may be a little bit better distance indicators than the ones in late type galaxies. Although once we correct for light curve shape and dust, we see no residual dependence of their distance on the type of galaxy in which we see them. They seem perfectly consistent in terms of the cosmology with the ones in late type galaxies. We also see ones where we see practically no galaxy at all. And so here's a number of examples of this. Presumably these are faint little blue galaxies that we're hardly seeing, but you know, it's still quite impressive to see a type 1a supernova pop out of apparently nowhere. But you know, if there was a small Magellanic cloud, or in some cases a large Magellanic cloud there, we wouldn't see that anyway. What's one thing that's very nice about finding these very high redshift supernovae is that some of the low redshift supernovae we see in the foreground can be seen through a large amount of extinction. And so here's a few examples where we've seen type 1a supernovae with a couple of magnitudes of extinction at intermediate redshift. And these are the kinds of objects we can use to begin to constrain the extinction law that we sort of guess at intermediate redshift, put constraints on that. Of course, we also see multiple supernovae in the same galaxy at high redshift. This happens at low redshift, so why wouldn't that happen at high redshift? But it's, you know, sort of some of the things that we also see. So Let me move on to a discussion of rates, because I think this is interesting. And in particular, I don't think it jibes as well with some of the models that we've been discussing. So really, this is work by Lou Strolger et al., Tomas Dahlin et al. From a few years ago. And then I'll show you the update that should come out soon in a paper by Dahlin et al., 2007. And so this is the idea that the star formation rate plus this, what we call the delay time, but the amount of time or characteristic function of time it takes to assemble this type 1a supernova should yield the supernova rate that we see. And so you guess at, well, you try to use your best knowledge of the star formation rate, and here's two extreme ranges of ones from ones that are sort of flat to ones that decline at higher redshift. I think that pretty much brackets the reasonable range of star formation. And then this is the observed, the histogram of the supernovae. The ones in black are the ones that we're most certain are type 1a supernovae. The ones in gray, we're not quite as sure. But this is a good data set for identifying the type because it's a rolling search. So we have light curves for all these things. We have colors. We know they're all fresh supernovae because we had just observed 45 days earlier. The majority of these have spectra. And now after making many observations, and this is a famous field, the Goods field, we have spectra, spectroscopic redshifts for about 90% of these hosts. So I think we're unlikely to be able to move new objects in or out of this this histogram very much. And so what do we see? Well, here's this is a volume rate for the supernova. And the points in gray were what Strolger et al. And Dahlin et al. Had published a few years ago from just the Goods survey. And now with PANS, which is a couple more years of data, we have the points in gray, which are consistent, the points in black, which are consistent with the previous ones. What is quite noticeable is these two component models, these sort of A plus B, the tardy and the prompt components. They sort of try to drive through most of the data, but at the high redshift end, they are really over-predicting the number of supernovae we see at the high redshift end. In fact, in particular, you know, in this bin at redshift 1.6 and this bin at redshift 1.2, don't have nearly as many supernovae in the survey as these simple models would suggest. In particular, redshift 1.6, I think in that bin we have a few objects, and we should have, according to which of these two, this is the, I think, the Minucci and the largest paper, we should have about 15 supernovae. So, you know, I don't know why this is, but I guess let me just show you a little bit about why I'm pretty convinced that we're not simply missing objects. And it really comes down to the detectability of these faint objects, but I can convince you that we still go a lot deeper than we need to go to find these objects. And so one strong line of evidence is if you look at the histogram of the discovery magnitudes of the type 2s we see, which are basically the things that are blue in the ultraviolet, and the type 1As, which are red in the ultraviolet, you can see we have very few in this range of the type 1As, which would be these highest redshift bins. But we find plenty of core collapsed supernovae at that same brightness. So it's not a problem finding objects at that brightness. And just to convince you even further, here's what type 1a supernova looks like at redshift 1.4. Here's a couple of objects that we did find, and these are still about 15 sigma detections that are more than a magnitude brighter than our magnitude limit. And there's a nice poster by Steve Rodney which demonstrates this. He refers to this as an iceberg plot, but basically it's what the peak magnitude of a type 1a supernova looks like as a function of redshift, and then you convolve with the luminosity function of type 1a supernovae and the extinction distribution for type 1a supernovae, which broadens this. And you can see that even at redshift 1.5, if you look at our 90% completeness and 50% completeness, we are finding the great majority of the type 1a supernovae that should be there, unless something dramatically changes with the properties of the supernovae. And I mean, Andy Howell's work also showed that the ones that we are finding seem to be the ones associated with young populations, and yet they just stop being there at high redshift. And I think after 3 years of doing this and two different surveys now, I'm sorry to think this is just a something part of the data that we're just going to have to understand. And the last thing I want to say, another advantage to going to even higher redshifts than we have been going previously, this is an idea in a recent paper by myself and Mario Livio, is that the next generation of supernova surveys in space, these JDAM experiments, are based on the premise of collecting thousands of supernovae and really understanding and convincing yourself that there's not evolution at the percent level. And most of the work goes on in this dark energy sensitive region, redshift from low to about 1.5, where most of the action is in dark energy. Now, presuming that you've made those measurements up to redshift 1.5, you look at then what the changes are due to your knowledge of the dark energy parameters as a function of even higher redshifts. And the story becomes much simpler at higher redshift because under almost any circumstance, the universe is going to be dark matter dominated and will be very insensitive to dark energy. And yet, if there's evolution, presumably, again, the lever arm continues to grow. And so if you made measurements of supernovae in this region, this would be with something like a JWST, or even this is possible to begin this with the HST with the wide field camera 3. If you saw departures from this region, you would either know that the supernovae are evolving or something's going wrong and all bets are off, or maybe dark energy is doing, you know, throwing us another curveball. But either way, seeing points off this this very simple prediction that's pretty dark energy independent would be an important verification of later results for dark energy. So I won't say the end, but I will say that this is to be continued after hopefully the astronauts get back up to HST next year and put wide field camera 3 on, and with any luck are able to repair the short in ACS. Thank you.
Well, we have some time for questions.
I will begin with the first question. So from looking at your rates, I would naively predict there will be no supernovae to observe at redshift between 2 and 3.
Right. So that's a good point. So in the paper, we had been using a delay time of, I think, 3.5 gigayears. And so there are still type 1a supernovae out there, just, you know, you just have to search more volume. It would certainly be easier to find them if the delay time was shorter. But, you know, we used a model that was fitting our data at the high redshift end. So it's factored in there right now, but, you know, maybe we'll find them. Maybe, you know, that won't be right.
Great.
So I was trying to count. It looks like you had, out of the 23 at high redshift, 9 in ellipticals.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Was that actually a correct inference? Because you didn't give us the difference. So
These 9 aren't.
Okay, so in terms of so what's your sense then of the population distribution at these redshifts? So I think from the legacy survey, I think they should speak for themselves, but from what I've seen on their rate expectations, 9 out of 23 at this high redshift would be a surprise. For passive versus active star form.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Let's see. Well, so I've dropped down to about redshift to 0.9 to count these. So we probably have about 30. And this one actually was in the original Hubble Deep Field, was not part of our survey. So it's probably about 8 out of 30. That's our.
I guess I would encourage you to that's a constraint. That's a very important.
Okay.
The other issue is that the challenge, as you saw from Chris Pritchett's talk, is that you have to also be sure that any delay function you construct does not embarrass you when you look at nearby galaxies. So the issue that came up with your previous work is that if all type 1As are delayed by 3 gigayears, if there's a shifted Gaussian, you have a real problem with local galaxies, because you should see spirals where the 1A rate exceeds the core collapse rate.
Right. So
we don't observe.
So I don't mean this to sound like a cop out, but I'm not advocating. I would say from the data I've seen, I would not advocate a long delay as much as I would say we don't see the prompt supernovae at high redshift. And I don't know why that is. I mean, maybe it's this story of sort of it takes a minimum metallicity to, you know, push the wind. And I mean, there was a series of papers by Kendamoto a number of years ago suggesting that this kind of thing might happen that has nothing to do with populations, but has more to do with having enough metallicity to push the wind and allow the type 1A supernova progenitor to form.
Can you put your rate back up?
Sure. Nope, wrong way. Sorry. Yeah.
So what's the dash line there?
Let's see, I'd have to look very closely. There was the Neil et al. Paper.
Okay. So if you the open circles there are Barrett and Tonry, right? And
these points are Barris and Tonry,
right?
Correct.
So those aren't really spectroscopic 1As, right? Those are...
Yes,
so,
that is right.
So a lot of people don't like those. So
that's right. I agree.
Right. So if you took this Neil sort of prediction there, basically, then your point at high redshift is sort of one-ish sigma off, and so is the one a little bit before that. So
yeah.
I mean, it's not so bad.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, Barris and Tonry aren't here to defend these points, but I mean, I understand what you mean, that they've looked photometrically only at things that varied and didn't have spectra for most of these. So
at the highest redshift, with what confidence can you really say that these are type 1a supernovae?
I showed the spectra that we had.
But do you get spectra for all of them? Don't include anything without spectra?
So if you look at this breakdown, right, I would say, where is it? So things in black, which we call gold and silver, for the purpose of rates, I mean, we're quite sure these are type. They all have a very compelling reason to be a type 1a supernova. In 90% of the cases, we probably have a spectrum that, you know, was a type 1a supernova.
10%.
And then there are some, I mean, basically there's still this sort of rule that if it's in an elliptical host, we maybe with one exception, maybe with no exceptions, have ever seen a non-type 1a supernova with an elliptical host. So I think it would be very hard. I mean, you could, you know, I wouldn't argue with you about these gray points. You could sort of move them around a little bit. They're less certain. But these ones in black are awfully hard to move.
Anyone wants to comment about non-type 1a supernova in early type galaxies?
But you would have had to misclassify only a few 1As as core collapse in order to really get your rate up at the highest redshift bin.
Yeah, but if anything, the problem is the other way around. I mean, the more likely contaminant is, because we're selecting things by this UV deficit, that you have some 1Bs and 1Cs that are in the 1A group, where as opposed to what you want to do is take things that are, you know, these UV blue things and move them to the 1A pile. And I mean, you know, then they're just not type 1A supernovae. I mean, if they have, you know, if they have flux in the ultraviolet, they have, you know, electron scattering, you know, hydrogen envelope or something. So
did you get ICS grisms for any of the things that you decided were probably core collapse and therefore could be thrown away?
We have a few, but I mean, they are generally things that we did not trigger on. I mean, this is a program that was designed not to do rates, but to do cosmology with type 1A supernovae. It's very expensive to get these spectra with a little 2.4-meter telescope. So we did not follow up generally things that that look to be a core collapse supernova. There's some that are in the same field. So I would say a handful of cases, you know, and they always did look like core collapse supernovae, but you know, we don't have most of them. But again, I don't know how you get something that in the ultraviolet is blue. I mean, just a flat SED, and we're gonna end up calling it a type 1A supernova somehow.
Okay, we'll do Andy and Mike and Lars, and we'll take some questions.
Okay, getting back to Lars's point about how many ellipticals you have, if it, in some cases I know you're just saying it's a 1A because it's in an elliptical, then that you can't really use that as an indicator of the true population because it's a selection effect, right?
Right.
And the other question about that is
So you're saying there can occasionally, you're saying at high redshift, there may occasionally be a core collapse supernova.
He was saying you cannot count ellipticals out of the total sample because some of them are only there because they're in ellipticals.
Yeah, because so like if they're in spiral, you wouldn't have.
Or silver because of the host, and therefore the host demography is biased. Right?
No, but this is a volume-based rate. I mean, I'm just pointing out what some of the.
Yeah, but Lars suggested another test. He said, let's look at the host fraction, which is elliptical versus others, in the gold and silver. But the gold, being in an elliptical galaxy, could put you inside the sample, and therefore.
It would just throw off the proportion of ellipticals to spirals, because one could have been in a spiral, you wouldn't have called it a 1A, but since it's an elliptical, you always call it a 1A, so therefore you have the maximum amount of ellipticals you could possibly have.
I don't think that's true, because, I don't think that's true, because, you know, if you do the rates properly, if it shows up in a spiral, you still attempt to classify whether it's a type 1A or a non-type 1A. It's just what your level of confidence is. So that would be like saying, you know, if we took a spectrum, we see it's a type 1A. If we didn't take a spectrum, we still have to figure out whether it's going in the 1A or non-1A pile.
Well, then that argues that there's a lot of non-1As that are in the 1A pile, right? If you have to put them into something.
Right, you do have to put them into something. Otherwise, you don't have a complete. But that's why we use this confidence level. And I'm saying, you know, for 95% of the things we have, we're very confident because, you know, we have a good reason.
As you know, we differ on that, but that's okay. The red galaxies here. So how do you decide what's an elliptical or what's not? Is it just, you know, you look at them? And,
No. Well, we have SEDs for these things. This is the goods field. So we have, you know, from the ultraviolet to the far infrared, SEDs for all these things. So we look at, you know, things like R minus K colors. But yeah, we also look at the morphology. I mean, there are people who are studying galaxy morphology in the goods field. And so, you know, we have excellent analysis of the types of the galaxies in the goods field.
I don't think you make a claim that you're not zero.
Well, that's where I would use the SED more, but yeah.
So, Adam, speaking of doing the rates properly, I mean, I think we're all very interested or drawn to the last bin. But you draw that, right?
The last bin.
And that's very relevant to all these questions, right? And it's all in that bin.
Yes.
And I emphasize the word because binning is not the right way to do the analysis. And it's certainly not that you have an error bar on your bin.
Yes.
It is you have a prediction for the number of supernova you should see, and I'll keep it simplistic. If you did it in a bin,
yes.
Each model predicts how many you should see. The error is not on the observed, it's on the thing.
This
the other way to do it is to count how many. You know, it's not to a bin analysis because it's very sensitive.
Let me say, this problem does not go away if you change the binning.
And we'll see that in the $1.07?
Yes.
That'd be great.
Very brief question. With what confidence would you say that this is this significant? Is it the three sigma effect, or would you not put that
as... Well, as we were talking about, it probably depends more what model you use. I mean, what you use for the star formation rate, whose model you use, whether you throw out the Barris and Tonry points. So it's hard for me to say, but... So I don't know. You know, a couple of sigma? My gut feeling is that there are not that many type 1A supernovae at very high redshifts.
Okay, let's thank Adam again. This was the conference here at San Diego State University.